This month at PostWrestlingCafe.com, it's your home for XL editions of Rewind to Raw, Dynamite, and SmackDown as we go live for our patrons on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday with XL editions containing the news of the day, questions, and feedback. And throughout the month of January, you get a free month when you sign up for a full year. PostWrestlingCafe.com.
Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Less $830 trade-in slash promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Rewind the dynamite from the post wrestling site. AEW, lighting up the fuse. Sit back and enjoy the bubbly. As we hear from John and Waitay. Where we're going, we don't need roads. And if the buck stops here, this thing might blow. Everything you hear, opinions of the show. And if you don't like it, go to the forums and let them know.
And hello, everybody. Welcome to Rewind to Dynamite. It is John Pollock, and joining me tonight as we sift through the world of AEW's maximum carnage, it is our maximum co-host, Bruce Lord, who is here with us, beard in tow. Hello, a happy new year to you, Bruce, and thank you so much for sitting in with me tonight as we chat about tonight's first night in Cincinnati.
Absolutely, John. Thank you so much for having me. Happy New Year to yourself. And, you know, it's a period of upheaval and anarchy, John. Rampage and Level Up are canceled. SmackDown is 3 hours, but apparently not for long. The menu at the Post Cafe has undergone a redesign. Now you've got the New Japan guy sitting in on the AEW desk. It's maximum carnage, human sacrifice, dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria, to quote Bill Murray. But yes, I am very, very glad to be doing a show with you for the first time in a while and to talk about Dynamite at this particular moment in AEW's history.
Well, I think the AEW production team knew that you were coming tonight, as we did get one vignette of a particular wrestler preparing for his long-awaited return by sipping back on some bourbon. Maybe you had a key.
Oh, no. That was Japanese whiskey, my friend.
Oh, my goodness. So that was top shelf. Okay.
I don't know about top shelf. It's the Hakushu 12. It's a nice whiskey. I've had it in the past. Little bit juicy, fair bit of peat in it. I was looking it up, actually, after I noticed that MVP was enjoying it. And I'm like, man, the price on that one has really gone up. But I don't know. Maybe that's the flex that MVP was choosing to exercise there.
Yeah. And I think we will all assume Shelton Benjamin was going dry this month with his beverage of choice. That looked a few shades away from a Shirley Temple.
Yes, definitely. But hey, that's a responsible decision that many folks make in January.
Well, folks, we are going to be going through all of tonight's Dynamite Maximum Carnage show. And then for those of you that are in the Post Wrestling Cafe, strap on your seatbelts, sit back, because after the review, we are going to be continuing on the cafe and we'll be going through all of the news from today, a number of legal stories, one concerning Odyssey Jones that we have just reported on the site earlier tonight, as well another case involving Conor McGregor. We will discuss that, and we are going to be going through some other items, including Bruce and I, we will get to the bottom of the Corey Graves situation. We're going to talk a little bit about New Beginning coming up, and what is the temperature for this Sunday's The People versus GCW? The Honorable Bruce Lord will render his decision, and we will see where things stand as GCW returns to the Hammerstein Ballroom. All of that is coming up during the news portion on the Post Wrestling Cafe, so consider going XL at Post Wrestling Cafe. cafe.com. And I would be remiss not to mention that Thursday night, a week later, but the takes have been maximized. WH Park returns to post-wrestling. This is like our returns next week graphic that we could have had last week. He was ill last week, but WH will reunite with Karen Peterson for post-pro-res Thursday night. And I am sure that WH has plenty to share from our recent adventures in Japan and all the wrestling that went down over the last couple of weeks. And then Rewind to SmackDown, Collision Course coming your way this weekend, and we'll have coverage of the GCW show and TNA Genesis. Right off the top, Bruce, of the events that are going down this weekend, is there anything that really spurs your interest? Collision included, which is this is a beefed up Collision on Saturday night.
Well, you know, TK gives with one hand and takes away with another as far as Collision goes. I know that there's been a lot of discourse about one particular multi-man match that will be happening this Saturday. We can maybe cross that bridge when we get to it with in the review with the various...
The most divisive 12-man tag in pro wrestling history.
Absolutely, absolutely. But another straightforward singles match for, you know, one of AEW's many mid-card titles that was, I think, formally announced on tonight's Dynamite is what really, really grabbed my attention and has pretty much that makes Saturday a lock for me, I would say.
All right. Well, that is all coming up as well. I will have a UFC 311 show coming up this Sunday with Eric Marcotte, as that is going down Saturday night from the Intuit Dome that WWE fans will now be very familiar with. But we start things off going to our first night at the Brady Music Center in Cincinnati, Ohio. WrestleTix reporting a final figure of 1,566 tickets distributed. What did you think about the venue choice, Bruce? We have talked about kind of more intimate venues for AEW. This would qualify as one. Did you think the atmosphere was a plus, negative, somewhere in between?
I thought overall the actual atmosphere and look of the room was a real plus. I mean, we can, you know, sit here and debate until the cows come home whether or not running venues that you can tell are smaller than an NBA arena or whatever it might be is a good look for the company. But I definitely think that the atmosphere that this crowd had was a lot better than, you know, those cases where you've only maybe got, you know, 20-30% occupancy in some of those bigger rooms. And the fact that the layout of this building, which I have to imagine I've never seen a wrestling show broadcast in before, was really, really interesting, with like the second and kind of the third levels kind of raised up, and then also very much abutting against kind of the proscenium or whatever it might be, kind of almost like gave you a little, like, you know, welcome to the Thunderdome sort of feel in terms of with the gating and the cage on some of the fencing as well there. So yeah, no, really, really cool looking venue. I thought that did add something definitely to, you know, again, 1500, not great numbers for the flagship, you know, program of the number two promotion in the States, at least theoretically. But in terms of look and atmosphere, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, if you were going to tell me maybe a year ago that this entire lineup would be on free television and it would be Kenny Omega's first match in a year in this company, and it's 1,600, yeah, it's not a number you're going to be citing on the broadcast. But I'm going to say, if you're drawing 1,600, I'd much rather be in a venue like this than the Heritage Bank Center in Cincinnati, where it's 1,600 and it's that empty feeling. So I think this is kind of the route to go if this is where the demand is at. Multiple returns on tonight's show, including Taz, who is at ringside with Tony Schiavone and Excalibur. And Excalibur calling this essentially a pay-per-view for you here tonight, as we go into a video package teeing up all of the matches for tonight, and a very stout card on paper, I would say, going into tonight's show, Bruce.
Yeah, it was a pretty strong one looking, I don't know if I'd go so far as to say a pay-per-view, but it was a strong card going in. And I did like the fact that they had that whole little, you know, whatever, 3-minute opening bumper vignette, whatever you want to call it. I think pretty much everything on this show was effectively a lock by Saturday. So yeah, you know, to put a little bit of production into this and let folks know what they're getting for these 2 hours. I will say that the Death Riders portion of the opening vignette was a real sort of roller coaster, starting with the Danielson assault, and then the, you know, lightly taping the Rock and Roll Express to some staging, then throwing Darby, you know, down a flight of stairs. It's just a real roller coaster in terms of the level of violence that faction's been dealing out.
Yeah, you do realize a lot in some of these video packages how specific some of a lot of these are to Collision, that if you're not watching and you're just getting a catch up, like, when were Ricky and Robert in here? When were we? Pretty much there was a portion where they said, if you have not been following the war of words between Hangman and Christopher Daniels, check it out. And yeah, it's like that's pretty much been a Saturday program that will culminate this Saturday. But we get into Brian Cage, assisted by Don Callis and Lance Archer, taking on the returning Kenny Omega. And Cage immediately targets the midsection. I think this is going to be the target for every single Kenny Omega match from here on out, as everyone is out to destroy the man's guts. And early on, he teases the Terminator dive, but Archer gets involved, gets knocked off, and Omega, who is wearing that cut from Dynasty that has not healed yet, and gets busted open here midway through the match after he gets military pressed onto the desk. And of course, this is the solid oak desk, so this is doing even more damage than the previous desks, of course, as we've gone over. And then Archer and Callis get in on the attack. Callis worried he broke his hand striking the back of Kenny Omega. We see the deadlift vertical by Cage into the ring, and then in a callback to some of Tony Schiavone's The Greatest Night in Pro Wrestling History moments on Nitro, says, "This feels like one of the biggest matches and most important matches we've had in a long time. Maybe ever. Maybe ever. This match, Brian Cage, Don, and Kenny Omega in Cincinnati, the most important of all time."
I mean, look, it is a first-time singles match. I will give Tony that. I made a point of looking this up, and it just feels like one of those matches that had to have happened in PWG in, like, 2015, and yet never did. So, I mean, I, like, you know, look, I was legitimately interested in this. I thought it was a very good choice for Kenny's return, obviously pointing towards other business with Callis and whatnot. But, yeah, come on, let's save something for the main event here, Tony.
We also had, for the setup here, the elevated ramp on the way to the ring. So they incorporated that quite a bit throughout the night. Down the stretch, we see Omega with, like, the springboard into the Dr. Wily bomb and then a V-trigger for two. They really picked it up here at the end. Flying knee and another V-trigger by Omega. Hoists up Brian Cage onto his shoulders, which was quite the visual, as he proceeds to hit the one-winged angel and pins Brian Cage in 11:50. And Tony Schiavone, just going with what comes to mind, says, "What a gut check, if I can say that, regarding Kenny Omega." And Omega gets his arm raised here, but a very entertaining opener to start things off.
Yeah, it was very entertaining. Obviously, I think assuming that, you know, he is 100% healthy, clear to go, and that, you know, worked body shots are not going to be giving him any real problems. I do think that the whole midsection thing is going to be a real blessing for Kenny and for his opponents in matches like this. And it really was a case, a match of two sides of just, you know, Cage working over the midsection and then the fire up from Kenny that, you know, kind of, I think, nicely reintroduced, you know, the AEW viewer to his moveset. Apologies, Phil. Nice to see the Dr. Wily bomb in there again and a bunch of stuff like that. So, yeah, you know, I do think that this was a really smart way of reintroducing Kenny. I was wondering if there was perhaps, in terms of, you know, you're mentioning Tony referring to a gut check there. I was kind of wondering if the F5 that Brian Cage was using. I don't know if you can remember the Brian Cage's particular name for his F5, John.
The F5000.
No, that'd be the deep sea diverticulitis.
Oh, Jesus.
Working on which did not get mentioned on camera there. So yeah.
Wow. Well, there you have it, everyone. we'll have a lot to talk about when it comes to a specific wording that was used on this show.
Oh boy.
But I mean, I think Omega coming in, he does feel as though he has got this just this renewed spark to AEW coming in. And after the match, Archer and Kyle Fletcher get involved. Kyle Fletcher winds up and punches him in the gut when Will Ospreay runs out. Big response for him. And like last week, they clear the ring. They have the long stare toward one another. And then Takeshita comes out in his chucks and squares off with Omega, allowing Fletcher to hit a snapdragon. And then Ospreay comes back into the ring. They beat them all down. The Callis family beat them down, hitting a raging fire and brainbuster, leaving Omega and Ospreay. So, I mean, we kind of looked at this last week of just all these things that you have set up. It would seem the tag is the route to go, and then you can go, man, you can mix and match this, but it does feel like Omega and Takeshita is probably your big match that could be Revolution if you can hold this off for another 2 months.
Yeah, and it's wonderful that you could, I think, weave both Omega Takeshita and Ospreay and Fletcher together while then also teasing this whole Ospreay Omega situation. And I also like the, you know, in addition to the actual opportunities that this presents, I like the actual presentation of this beatdown and run in afterwards. I like seeing Ospreay run in without the music going off, you know, giving it that sense of immediacy. I thought the fact that even after the beatdown that the two of them were kind of left to sort of sell and react. You know, we talk a lot about how Dynamite often feels like just such a bang, 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 go, go, go sort of show, that actually just focusing on Ospreay and Omega, too much talent in this company, Ospreay and Omega lying in the ring afterwards was a good little visual there. The math kind of makes sense with them, with the heels getting the advantage with Cage and Archer in tow. But I don't think that this diminishes, you know, either Takeshita or Fletcher, on the path in any sort of way. And on the New Japan sideshow, I know that everybody, all of the diehard New Japan fans that I know, are very much interested in how Takeshita is going to be presented in this particular feud and program. We know that obviously it was, you know, Kenny who helped to bring, you know, Takeshita over from DDT during the lockdown period and appear on Dark, and I think worked a Dark match with him, if I'm remembering correctly. That's right. So, you know, obviously, so Omega is going to be game to give it as good of a position as it can. You just sort of hope that it is presented as big and as grandly as is possible, given Takeshita and AEW discourse right now.
Then we had the preparation of the Hurt Syndicate and MVP's first match in 2.5 years, this being our first erasure of GCW from any kind of history here. The Josh Barnett match never happened. The man also did an independent shot a month ago, but we won't let that get in the way. So for the sake of AEW's chronology, this is MVP's first match since July of 2022 in WWE. But before that six-man, it's a New York Minute with Chris Jericho referring to the heart that they are in the heart of the bluegrass state and promote the much maligned 12-man tag on Collision, and Brian Keith noting that that's a dozen motherfuckers. Cope is a dope. Harwood is no good. And Wheeler is a kneeler. Poetry.
Yeah. Yeah, and then fantastic stuff, Chris. I mean, the fact that he did call it the quote biggest, most anticipated match in Collision history. Like, you obviously this is Jericho trolling, you know, geeks like myself for pulling our hair out over this match. I'm not sure that I'm a fan of ever using kind of like who booked this as heat, but it is what it is.
Well, he does address the lingering question. Why would Chris Jericho team up with Jon Moxley? Well, I've known him for a long time. And I guarantee that we'll be on the same page, right?
Was there some sort of coded like page thing or something like that that I was missing out on this one? I was trying to kind of parse that one, if there was some sort of implication or meeting there, or if it was just a hoping that Mox is not going to just immediately destroy and lay out the learning tree as soon as they win the match or whatever.
If ever there was a time to link all their histories together, we have the learning tree. And what do you plant a tree in? It is Mitch the potted plant, and maybe all gets put back together with the Jon Moxley connective tissue.
Justice for Mitch. Yep.
Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance, but a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Less $830 trade-in / promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Support for this post-wrestling podcast comes from those of you who have picked up our merch over at Chalk Tees. T-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, and hats from post-wrestling and our network of shows, including the NWA Podcast, Poison Rana, The Long and Winding Royal Road, WrestleNomics, and MC Later. Free shipping to almost anywhere in the entire world. No minimum spend required. That's chop-tees.com/post-wrestling.
Ricochet comes out with the golden scissors in his breast pocket and got like a really good negative response from the crowd that whether he was just kind of, you know, on the fly, just egging it on, did a very good job of just intensifying the crowd. They were going into swerve chants, into boos. It was like a really good reaction for Ricochet. And then he throws up the image of the bloody swerve on the screen, and Swerve's music plays, which is a distraction as Prince Nana comes from behind, laying out Ricochet with the chair. So then Swerve comes out with his chain, and Ricochet escapes the chain shot and ends up backpedaling through the crowd, out the doors, and we never see the man again. He is just out in the cold. And that would have been a great analogy, I would say, a few months ago for Ricochet. But at this point, they have gotten this guy back on track, and they would make the announcement of Swerve and Ricochet in 3 weeks' time in Atlanta on that particular edition of Dynamite.
Yeah. I guess that's just too much of a hold off for Revolution, you know, without any kind of seconds to sort of stand in along the way for either man. That makes sense to kind of blow it off earlier. But yeah, I thought this was really good. I thought the scissor angle itself was really good, pivoting away from, you know, just Ricochet getting wedgied in the locker room or whatever it might be. It should be a good feud for both. I am interested to kind of see, this is really going to be kind of like Ricochet's first kind of organic in-house soup to nuts AEW program that isn't built on, you know, the existing Ospreay history or whatever it might be. And I thought Swerve looked really good here too. I like the fact that we have Swerve being dirty enough to have Nana jump Ricochet from behind. Obviously we saw it with Paige, but Swerve does, you know, kind of pissed off babyface who's willing to fight dirty and break the rules really well. And I think that plays to his strengths.
And given the time we have of 3 weeks to build this up, I could see you kind of getting another big heat angle on Ricochet by him taking out Nana for the chair shot. And, you know, I do think it's important to keep that edge with Ricochet. It seems like they can get away with like the cowardly Ricochet, but I think you also want to, like, Nana is a good target for something like that that you could go into this match with potentially. Mm-hmm. We saw a video package on Mercedes Moné's media tour going on the Sherry Shepherd show, shopping for jewelry and training. That was her involvement on the show. Private Party and Mark Briscoe against the Hurt Syndicate. So this was an interesting match. So we have the crowd that is pretty pro MVP as they beat on Mark Briscoe. And I would love to know from last week's Lashley match to this one, where they sit down is like, all right, this is how this is going to go, Mark. We're taking 90% of this. We're going to beat you and beat you and beat you and beat you. You can get the odd shot in, but we're going to continue to beat you down. And that was pretty much Mark Briscoe's role in this match, to just be destroyed by the heels. Finally, Private Party entered. They do conjure up some chance, and then they get into their hardy spots, including the poetry in motion. But when going for the twist of fate, Quinn is sent into a slam by Lashley. Lashley spears Cassidy. Running boot by MVP takes out Briscoe. And then it's Shelton with the German and super kick, pinning Quinn clean in 9 minutes and 25 seconds, stating their desire for the tag titles. By the end of this, I didn't know if we necessarily had to shoehorn MVP and Briscoe into this, but if we could have just gone the non-title route. But I mean, you can have two opinions here. If you think like the Hurt Syndicate are an act that is worth getting behind, they are pushing them super, super strong. but it is like they took like 90% of this, but they are going very strong with them.
And a whole lot more of MVP actually in ring than I think.
Oh, yeah. This was not like the manager that was just in there for, like, he was.
This wasn't the Gato spot, no.
Oh, no. He was their equal in this match, if not the superior in this.
If, if nothing else, that was kind of nicely set up on Saturday with MVP getting really, really pissy about Briscoe using a chair in the singles match. So like there was actually a bit of organic build there. You know, obviously, I think that they were sort of using Briscoe kind of not only as like the guy to carry the match, but also as kind of the human shield to keep people from entirely 100% getting behind the Hurt Syndicate. You know, the response for the Private Party hot tag was not really that great, not that audible. I thought, given how much heat had been put on it, there was the spot where, as you said, Private Party were going, setting up the Poetry in Motion, and it just kind of seemed to take too long to come together. And you compare that with just how fast and immediate and savage all of the Hurt Syndicate power offense that finished this match off was. And just, yeah, I think this is kind of... I think this is kind of a fait accompli going ahead. I think, you know, I would absolutely have the Hurt Syndicate just massacre Private Party for the tag belts. Give them a lengthy monster run while you figure out what you want to do in terms of heating somebody up. I not to put my Moxley did nothing wrong hat on, but there's a hell of a lot of truth in what he was sort of saying about Private Party, I think. And apart from the couple of matches that they've had, I don't see much to be done with them holding the belts for an extended period. And the difference in these two teams and just which seemed hotter right now, I think really puts the lie to that.
It's unfortunate because the title win, like that was it, like those two Bucks matches were just to me like career matches for Private Party. They got off on such a hot foot, but it's just been there's been nothing replicating that throughout this title reign. And if this is how it ends, I think you'd have to look at this as a bit of a failed experiment going with them that strong, beating the Bucks and sending them out.
Yep.
Several announcements for next week. So they make the announcement for next week. Cope and Pac, two men, seven letters in Knoxville, Tennessee, which should be quite the match. I enjoy seeing like Cope in just all these wild fantasy matches that he is just getting to live out and how he adjusts his style to these different guys. Then there was a feature on Rated FTR where we got, of course, the requisite photos of Brett and Steve Borden's son making a quick cameo in this video package. And then there was the announcement of Ricochet and Swerve. That is February 5th. But then we are going to get to our big talking segment of the night. Bruce, out comes Jeff Jarrett, who is immediately interrupted by MJF, who cuts off Jeff and says that I, referring to MJF, is already a Hall of Famer, and outlines the real legacy of Jeff Jarrett being the last thing you see before your favorite company dies. Poor shade on TNA here. He says
Is this the, you know, the who, you know, is the company, is the ratings are in the toilet? Is this the sort of heat that we want to be working? I don't know. But I mean, it foreshadowed the tone that the whole rest of this was going to be taking, if nothing else.
Something tells me that this is going to be the most discussed segment on the show.
Yeah.
He calls Jarrett the pro wrestling Grim Reaper, and that his career is enough. Looking at Jarrett's career is enough to make me want to drink. So let's get our Jeff Jarrett bingo card out. We have got failed wrestling companies, alcoholic, and then we would just keep them going here. So he mocks him for his battles with alcoholism, gets off track by just yelling at a fan, calling her a skank, and says that for the health of the company, why don't I just send you back to rehab, but keep your sexy MILF wife. She can stick around. Then I'm going to... This is one time where, Bruce, I'm sure you're glad I have to do the recap here as opposed to you.
Oh, yeah.
He will then ship her back to Tennessee so that Jeff can know what a generational talent and an Olympic gold medalist balls taste like. And Jarrett is just, he is amused. He is just sitting in the corner, amused, like just laughing at all of this, almost. It's almost like if we're not going to have these lines land in any discernible way, it kind of just felt a little gratuitous here. Jarrett just calls it all unoriginal material. It's been said 1,000 times. I know the best years of my career are behind me, but the AEW audience awakened a passion in me last summer during the Owen Hart Cup. Jarrett says that I was MJF before you were, which is quite the... That's quite the time travel here to get through in different timelines. But I've done and said everything that you've done, only I did it better. And I don't know if you're a dumbass or a scumbag, which prompted the crowd to just go, he's our scumbag, and just Jarrett had to kind of roll with it. So then he shifted to referring to MJF's mother as a call girl whose father paid for sex with his mother to have MJF, who was an ambulance chasing attorney, and calls his mother a Canadian call girl.
I have no idea what to make of any of this or what, like, I obviously, like, you know, fine, the Kurt Angle thing, the sort of thing that, you know, your average, you know, hardcore wrestling fan is probably going to know about. Whatever is happening with MJF's parents catching strays out here, I had no idea where this was going at this point. I mean, I got to your point about Jarrett no-selling all of the original singers, fine, by the end of this, you sort of came to understand why that was happening or what they were trying to have that lead to. But at this point, it seems like just both guys just completely unloading the clip about stuff that doesn't even really have much to do with any sort of match or their position in the company. Really, this was just, this was out of nowhere. This was out of left field. And, you know, it's one thing if it's MJF, you know, making a comment about Karen Jarrett, fine, he's nominally the heel in this. But when, you know, your theoretical babyface is just kind of dropping, like, your mom's a skank references out here, it's just like, right, it's, you know, it's somebody of Jeff Jarrett's generation. It's somebody who, you know, kind of had his biggest moments at a certain period in television, I suppose.
I mean, I got what they were going for here. I mean, they were trying to... I didn't think it didn't really connect with reality. Like, they were trying to explain, like, Jarrett was this type of heel a generation ago, which, I mean, he was a heel. I don't know if people necessarily equate him as, like, the shit-talking MJF that he's going to go to the gutter for, you know, his psychological warfare on opponents. But that was, like, the idea here, and I think it was just let's get as personal as possible to create this belief of this grudge that you're going to want to see this match by the end, and I think that's what people are going to judge this on. But we were continuing here because MJF says, Jarrett explains him, you need me because you're drowning in your own shit, which is the first time that shit
sorry to interrupt you, John, but I think you might have missed another person in MJF's circle who came under fire by Jarrett there.
Oh, that's right. He also referred... This one was like, I had to rewind it to get the exact... He likened MJF going 60 minutes with Bryan Danielson while concurrently his, quote, old lady was going 60 minutes with 10 wrestlers in the back during his match.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not...
That one got no reaction because I don't think anyone followed that tangent of, sorry, what? What was going on here? Can you say that a little slower?
And how many people actually know about MJF's relationship? I don't know what percentage of the AEW audience, the casual AEWans, knows about MJF's relationship with the current AEW backstage talent or on-screen talent. I don't know. But again, that just sort of felt like needlessly really nasty stuff, you know, theoretically coming from your baby face here.
This was where they were like, this really did feel as like one of those TNA segments that was written in such a way. And this was done to just like, this was the purpose of it. I think it was to go to find the line and go over the line in the sake of creating a grudge between these two. He calls MJF a scared little boy. He's scared to enter the gauntlet, scared his best years are behind him, scared of being on top, and scared of becoming a one-hit wonder, which for the second week in a row, the audience did get into the one-hit wonder chant. And that's when I thought this really did start to kind of take hold, because we had MJF, who I thought was like really good in like his reactions here. He says, I didn't need my daddy to be a top guy. I didn't need to start my own company to be a top guy. MJF made MJF. He takes credit for the largest show in company history, record ratings, record ticket sales, sound bites that I can definitely utilize for a future intro. And then he got screwed out of his title. His reputation was dragged through the mud, and he needs to win the title to shove it down all of his critics' throats. But I laugh that I've got to wait in line for a title shot behind Jeff Jarrett, and says, let's be honest, no fan has ever given a single solitary shit about Jeff Jarrett. You think because you were friends with Owen Hart, and he pauses, and it was like, oh my God, are they really going to invoke Owen Hart in this promo? He says that because you were friends with Owen Hart, you think you're owed some grand finale. Well, MJF saw right through Jarrett. You're nothing more than a leech riding the coattails of your deceased friend. And he goes to mention Owen again when Jarrett snaps, attacking him. Security runs out. Karen runs out. And then MJF grabs Karen before running off to the back. Now, I know a lot of focus is going to be on the first half of this promo. I understood what they were going for. I think that that is going to be the part that is going to be the most polarizing. But I will say, when they got into the MJF insecurities and they got into... Listen, I can understand a lot of people bringing up Owen Hart. I did not feel they crossed some, like I did not think this was a tasteless way to do it. Some might feel it was. But by the end of this, I thought they did get to the objective of this, where I thought both of them were very good in this segment. But I'm very curious to hear some of your thoughts on the segment.
I mostly agree. I think it went way too long. I think the kind of the tit for tat, just kind of crass, you know, your mama sort of stuff. Fine.
It just felt like it was out of another era.
It's just
almost.
Them doing the
even for MJF.
Them doing the dozens. Yeah. 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 No, it didn't really have any connection with reality. And the fact that, you know, Jarrett was going to no sell it, you know, kind of defangs the whole thing anyway. But by the time they did get into Jarrett sort of getting into, yeah, you're coming at me and you're saying all of this stuff because you're scared that you're never going to get back to the top again because you're insecure. That's good, because that is really ultimately what MJF has always been and what has always been best about the MJF character as a top heel. Somebody who, whether he has the belt or not, is terrified, is insecure, is scared, is just, you know, became a bully to, you know, not be bullied by those kids in high school, and is terrified that, you know, he's not actually going to be good enough. And so having that insecurity and having that sort of cowardice and fear be the thing that Jarrett hones in on more than just the parents and your girlfriend sort of stuff. Yeah, I think that's a really good angle for him. And then conversely, with the MJF and Owen thing, obviously let's touch wood and hope and assume that this was checked in, you know, that the hearts were kind of, you know, looped in on this one and whatnot, and this was given the okay. But, you know, that sort of line is something that I think people have sort of kind of noticed about the Jarrett thing, right? You know, the kind of the question of, we care about Jeff Jarrett a lot more than we did before. Yes, the Owen was this real big sort of shift in, I think, the modern wrestling populace or fan base caring about Jarrett a lot more because of that emotion related to the Owen thing. But there is something to that, right? There is something to this idea that this one, you know, tag team that he had God knows how many decades ago at this point is still the sort of thing that he's using to rev up and, you know, make one last sort of run at. The question as to whether or not some people would view that as a potentially exploitative thing, and I'm not saying that it is or that it isn't, but that's exactly the sort of line and angle that I would expect a psychological heel to go for and exploit. So I did really like the way that the Owen stuff was brought up here by MJF.
Yeah, I would say that if Owen was invoked for just some cheap line for some kind of reaction, I would have had a very different reaction to it. But I never felt that it was... It was something that he was trying to bring. He was trying to utilize an insecurity in Jarrett to combat what had just been thrust upon him. And I would be stunned if they had not cleared that in advance, as we have heard when they have done the rappelling from the ceiling and Martha had come out stating that they had run that by her. So, but by the end of this, I thought they got to where they were. And were you more intrigued in this program by the end of it? I have to say I was overall. So I have to look at that as a success at the end of it and where they go here. And I think it's something that this has... Like, I would not have said a year ago that MJF would need a Jeff Jarrett program to rehab from an Adam Cole one, but here we are. And I think that this has been very good for MJF, this program, to kind of almost like reset him after what's been a really difficult set of months, and not all on him either. Like, this is those two were just in a terrible scenario, and it was prolonged.
Yeah, and these sorts of areas, regardless of what we think about, you know, kind of some of the shots that were taken, this is the sort of place where MJF excels, you know, these sorts of promos that alternate between just absolutely savage below-the-belt shots that nobody else is willing to take, but then also betraying that insecurity as well. And I find this version of MJF a hell of a lot more interesting than Brochacho MJF or Devil, any of that nonsense that I think we are very thankfully leaving behind in 2024. Yeah, so new year, new scumbag. Let's hope.
Announced for Collision, we've got the Texas Deathmatch, the Big 12-man tag, and Kazuchika Okada, Tomohiro Ishii for the AEW Continental Championship. And we got a great video feature for this utilizing New Japan footage. And the setup for this of Ishii just walking up to Okada, doesn't shake his hand, just taps the belt. Boom, we've got a match for Saturday. And I this looks like a very good edition of Collision. Like, I think Hangman Daniels, that's a really intriguing match, and for Daniels to just go out there and have his kind of a Dustin Rhodes, I'm going all out type of match.
I loved that promo that Hangman cut on last Saturday, talking about the business with his family and whatnot, and how Swerve's violation of his house, you know, changed him and made him feel. I thought that was great. I'm glad that was used back in this package here, because I thought that, like, that's the stuff that, like, where has that guy been since the Swerve feud kind of, you know, went cold? Again, that's exactly the Hangman that I think the company needs right now. And yeah, holy crap, Okada Ishii. I mean, I'm gonna go back and rewatch their 2016 G1 match. I can't imagine that this on Saturday will necessarily live up to that, but still, that's gonna be great for nostalgia.
The Brady Music Center is getting this big follow-up. This month at PostWrestlingCafe.com, it's your home for XL editions of Rewind to Raw, Dynamite, and SmackDown, as myself and Wei Ting will be providing full shows containing news of the day, questions, and so much more going live on those nights for patrons. Plus, we will have coverage of Wrestle Kingdom 19, Wrestle Dynasty, The People vs. GCW, TNA Genesis, a Rewind Away retrospective on the Ric Flair-Ricky Steamboat feud of 1989, all of your regular shows, a Daredevil primer, and throughout the month of January, you get a free month if you sign up for an annual subscription. $6 a month at postwrestlingcafe.com. Christian Cage and Hook was next. So Hook jumps Cage on the ramp from behind, and Cage is trying to walk out. He's playing the coward throughout this, and then he's brought back to the ring, tries to hug Hook, who just belly-to-bellies him, and Cage is retreating to Mother Wayne. The patriarchy is out there, so Shibata comes out to back up Hook, and Hook tries to stomp the hand of Christian. Christian gets his hand out of the way and just pulls Hook's leg out from under him, and he crashes on the edge of these stairs. That looked no fun at all for Hook. Hits a series of frog splashes. Hook kicks out, and then Hook blocks the spear, and then Christian hits it on the second try. Hook kicks out at one, and you know what? I think Tomohiro Ishii should have dibs on the one count. The man is the master of them. Didn't quite get the crazy one count reaction here, but the red rum is applied. Cage balances his legs onto the top rope, so Hook just releases and the guy falls, and Cage comes from behind, lays out Shibata, and then goes for the kill switch into the red rum, and then Hook leaps onto the back, securing the submission, and cue Kip Sabian and Nick Wayne to run in for the DQ at 11 minutes and 39 seconds. I will say this, it was one of those like groan finishes, but they did give you something afterward, because Taz is losing it at ringside, and Kip Sabian, Nick Wayne, they bring in chairs. Taz stands up and he teases he's going to come to the aid of his son when Samoa Joe's music plays, and Samoa Joe comes out and he murders Kip Sabian and Nick Wayne, including just sidestepping the big stinger splash as Sabian leaps into Wayne, and Shibata just sent Chris Sabian into the next state with this penalty kick. And Taz remarks, I love when a plan comes together. So I love that all of this was hatched out. The DQ, the chairs would be brought in. All of this perfect came together. But at least I will say this. The end result was you were not left with this DQ as your final thing. You got like the big comeback, and then Hook, Shibata, and Joe standing together as a trio, and probably a match with the patriarchy in the foreseeable future.
In terms of the match itself, bell to bell, I did not think this was good. I mean, Christian did everything that he could here, moved heaven and earth, but I just don't think that Hook came off well, either in terms of the actual work or in character or in fire or the kickouts or anything that you're talking about there. The clubbing forearms did not look good. The jump onto Christian's back to lock the submission in, I didn't think that worked. On paper, right, this is a program that's been well executed, but it just feels like it's been going on forever in desperate need of the kind of injection of life that Joe represents here. But yeah, no, it's just, I'm glad that we're here. I'm glad that Joe is back. I mean, I kind of had, I was hearing rumblings of one of the debuts or arrivals that is still yet to come on the show. But I was also sort of looking at like when Joe was written off, and I'm like, how long can it take to shoot one more season of Twisted Metal? You got to think he's on his way back here. So, I mean, obviously a very, very welcome presence back in the company. But yeah, I don't know. Is Hook better off than he was a year ago? I don't know that I can say about that. You know, on the New Japan beat, we have another son of a current non-wrestling on-screen talent who is in an overly long feud with a would-be surrogate father who has a lot of talent kind of on the side propping him up. And that's not really working either. But hey, Joe's back, so I'm excited about that.
I think you can get by with Hook teaming with Joe, associated with Shibata. Like there's certainly they have put him in a role where he is, you know, fairly protected in this role, but I really feel to make, like, there is such a depth, and Hook just does not cross that threshold of, you know, yep. There are so many other guys ahead of him, and he's young enough that I think he would benefit so greatly from 6 months going somewhere and coming back fresh. And I think you could utilize that in such a great way. It doesn't have to be every person that you look at as, you know, that is ripe for that. But Hook to me is one that would benefit so greatly from that type of thing, that he comes back and you give him a new move here and just the experience of working with different people and consistently as well. I think that would be a big step for Hook, but I don't know if that's going to be an option they take.
Yeah, no, I mean, I was thinking the same thing, you know, Japan, Indies, something, you know, to just to give him that seasoning and to kind of give him that extra gear, because, again, you know, we can kind of, like you say, we can protect him and you can muster a lot of forces around him. But at the end of the day, you know, the proof's in the pudding. And at least for the portion, the bell to bell portion of the match, there wasn't much there with this.
We have various reactions to last week's men's casino gauntlet match, and I did kind of like this. This was all the losers talking, and it was kind of setting up these new goals, like the Undisputed Kingdom. They're going for gold. We had Kyle just offhandedly just remark about Daniel Garcia not being as great as people think he is. So it was like, this was 30 seconds, 60 seconds, and they created some like tension coming out of this that at least is a reason for some matches here. So they utilize this. We also heard from Jay White among the losers here. Renee speaks with Jeff Jarrett and in walks Dustin Rhodes. And I guess he watched that MJF segment and said, guess there's no more language restrictions. Cause this guy, how many shits did we get on this particular show?
At least a dozen.
This was the most we've had in the longest time. I think Nia Jax opened up the floodgates on Raw.
Dustin got like three off in this segment alone, I think. Yeah.
Dustin walks in, goes over their history together, says, MJF really pissed me off, and says that I want you to fulfill your goal of becoming AEW champion. And Jared is just looking like, let's be honest, Dustin, I'm going to try, but I might go a little smaller. He says, MJF doesn't know what you and I have been through. We've been dragged through shit. And outlaws never die. And we are the last of our kind. It's like Triple H and Undertaker before that WrestleMania. Remember that?
Direct quote, though, from Dustin. You're the last outlaw and outlaws never die. Well, then what happened to the other outlaws, Dustin? I was just finding myself questioning the logic here, but anyway. But no. Like Dustin's great in this sort of role. You know, he's always charming. He's always likable. It was a great little use of him.
And then we're going to the women's casino gauntlet match. But I think of note is we did get some, they didn't make a big deal about this, but on the graphic, we did get the details for Grand Slam Australia. It will air in the Collision time slot on February 15th on TNT and Max. So it feels like this is just going to be a 2-hour special. And I can't imagine they're going to go all the way to Australia just to do 2 hours. I would hope they tape something else in addition to it, but it does kind of, I think, from the announcement, this was initially going to be in a stadium. They have since reduced it to an arena in Brisbane, but it does feel like they have certainly downscaled this event where I don't even know if this is going to get like a real big like pay-per-view type of push as you would have assumed when this was first announced.
I mean, I think that, you know, they've been pointing towards a handful of matches, obviously the big women's one that we're coming up to here, as being tentpoles of it. I know that Jay White is technically not literally from Australia, but, you know, there's like, you know, you've got him, you've got Flight, you know, there's all manner of people that could be put into high profile positions with important singles matches that I do think would give this the feel of, you know, at least kind of like a winter is coming, you know, or a fighter fest type sort of feel. But yeah, no, you're right. It's like it 2 hours on a Saturday is not really, you know, a pay-per-view there. I don't know. Maybe we get a taped Dynamite out of it as well or something.
It's
like
also
that.
Bruce, like it's going to also be on a multi-hour tape delay as well. Like this will be happening early Saturday morning. So, I mean, it is a free special. So you will have that. I would assume like it's not going to be streaming live on Max. They were promoting 8 p.m. Eastern here on the graphics. So, but yeah, we're going to get the match coming out of this. I could certainly see that Omega and Ospreay against Fletcher and Takeshita or Fletcher and Cage or something like that. I mean, that's kind of the level I'm expecting for this, but, the Casino Gauntlet match, first of all, I thought the star of this match was Mariah May on commentary. I thought she was tremendous. She had so many great lines here. Like, this was very Nigel-esque, where every single woman that entered, she just tore them down, and she had some very witty lines. She talked about reminding us why Anna Jay cannot compete in this match because she can't challenge for the title. And she also said she would prefer just defending the title here in America, so she doesn't have to fly all the way to Australia to do this. And she probably realized for a collision. So anyway, Chris Statlander and Jamie Hayter start the match together. And number three is Megan Bain. And Excalibur explains, well, she appeared in AEW a long time ago on Dark, and she's been competing in Stardom of late, which was our second inference of GCW does not exist in our world.
Yeah, no, this was incredible to finally see this happen. I can only assume that this means that we are finally getting Michael Oku on Collision. I don't know, you know, after months and months of rumors of this. But no, the GCW erasure was very noticeable here, I thought. Just, she's around. She's a wrestler. You might know her from places. Yeah.
Yeah, Mariah May instantly asked, can she even win? Does she even have a graphic? Go to Tony Khan's account. And I thought Megan Bain accounted for herself very well. I thought she fit in seamlessly here. And I thought that her interactions, especially with Chris Statlander, you certainly would love to see a TV match between them coming out of this. Oh, yeah. So this was not the kind of debut where you just, you know, she was just one of many and you forgot about her after. I thought she had like a good presence in this match. Julia Hart was fourth, with Mariah May saying, I'm glad we have the short ramp so we don't get her whole entrance. And she goes right after Jamie Hayter renewing that program. And Statlander ends up taking a T-bone suplex from Megan Bain. Fifth is Willow Nightingale. And we get a brief interaction of Willow and Chris smiling at one another. And then they go into chops and Willow pounces her. Number six, it is Toni Storm who comes out. Huge reaction for her. And she goes to the snapmares right away. Chris Statlander hits a cannonball off the stage, taking out Bain and Willow. And then seventh is Harley Cameron, who is from Australia. And Mariah says, I would love for her to win. Then we could leave her in Australia. And there's a hate breaker to Cameron. She ducks the haterade. And Julia Hart sprays mist into Harley's eyes. And then Toni Storm runs in and takes Julia Hart and cradles her for the win in 13 minutes and 22 seconds. So we get to Mariah May and Toni Storm at Grand Slam next month.
As we knew it was going to be, as it was written. I will say about like the match itself and also just the setup to this, I liked that they've done, that they elected to do the first women's version of this match. I think it's a legitimately unique match construction. Feels like something that is a homegrown stipulation within AEW that is a real hit, unlike, you know, Christian walking around with the Money in the Bank type thing. You know,
or
and then, you know,
people being matched up with decks of cards.
Oh, gee. Yeah.
They really tried to make that one work, and it was a gallant effort, but this is definitely the superior Royal Rumble.
Yeah. And, you know, some buzz about Megan Bain on social media about an hour before the show went off, I think really helped this. Megan Bain and Stat trading off during the picture-in-picture, looking great. Obviously, Hayter looking good in there as well. And as Willow Nightingale was coming out there, I was thinking, man, Statlander, Hayter, Willow, now Megan Bain. There is so much talent in this ring. And yet we know that the main women's belt in this company is locked up in a feud as to whether or not Toni Storm remembers that she used to have a delusion about being a silent movie star or not. And just the failure of that whole thing to launch with me, and certainly my concerns and outright loathing for the amnesia angle were kind of looming over this, in as much as the actual match here I thought was really, really solid. And in terms of, you know, debuting a really strong new talent in Megan Bain, I do think that was done well. You know, there's always the talk about why introduce somebody in a Rumble, in a Battle Royale or whatever, if they're not going to win. I thought Bain got plenty here, and you set up and teased, as you said, all manner of interesting TV directions for her. I have a whole rant about the amnesia thing, but you don't want to hear that, and the listeners don't want to hear that. So
I just want to know what Toni Storm's reaction is if she watches this back and her record is listed 61-11, what that does.
Oh, did they have that on the cut? Oh, I missed that on the bug. Okay, all right.
Yes, so she's really racked up these wins in the last couple of weeks. I like this gauntlet. I thought that it was a great showcase. I didn't mind that they limited it to 7. I thought it was a good focus. Megan Bain, I mean, she's like the level of talent where, let's be honest, a good portion of people probably did not know Megan Bain or had not seen her before this. Yeah. And I thought she came in and she looked really good. And I wanted to see more of her with, especially Chris Statlander after. So I thought it was a fine introduction, and it keeps you, you know, tuning into these matches that you, with that idea that you don't know who's going to show up and you might get a surprise here or there. So I thought this was really well done, and it was the logical winner at the end of this. And now a month to see if she remembers anything before going back to Australia. We'll find out, Bruce.
Oh boy. I don't know if you or Wade catch the flu or something like that within the next month, and you need me to tag in. Fair warning. There's I might not be able to hold my loathing about this whole business back in. But yeah.
Well, we will see if you loved or loathed our main event, Jon Moxley and Powerhouse Hobbs. Take two after last year's attempt at Daly's Place, where Hobbs destroyed his knee in 4 different places, as they noted, and Moxley does a kind of a cribbed Matt Cardona's entrance from Final Battle last month, where he walked in from outdoors in the frigid cold. It was one thing for him to walk in. Dude, Marina Shafir must have been just like near hypothermia walking in. It looked absolutely frigid in Cincinnati. They walk into the building, and this was going to be interesting. Like, you're in Cincinnati and you were going to be getting at least a semi-pro Jon Moxley crowd. And I thought that, you know, it was split at times, but it wasn't as though they were just 100% for Moxley or anything like that. They got into Hobbs with the power spots, and he decided to, you know, go to the old reliable formula that always works: work on the ear. And he just leans down and bites Jon Moxley. He tries to bite the earring out. So you see him biting the ear, and then he just gets up and spits something out toward the floor. And we're to believe that that's either the earring or part of the man's ear. But Moxley just bled and bled from this ear. Let's give the man credit. He has bled from every conceivable angle of his head, that he is constantly finding new ways to introduce blood, and this from the ear throughout the match, which did give quite the visual to this.
We are finally at, like, you know, an hour and 55 or whenever this was. We finally got some carnage, maximum or otherwise, here. And, you know, hey, I mean, credit to Hobbs, you know, good fundamentals from the young man. Pick a body part, work it over. That's, you know, that's what we want to see in this business. So good work there, Hobbs.
So it was interesting. Like, Moxley was almost like becoming the babyface here. Like, he's collapsing, he's firing up as he's all bloody toward Hobbs. And then Hobbs gets caught by a cutter. Shafir gets involved at several points in the match, and Hobbs is constantly stopping the paradigm shift, and then catches him with not the world's strongest slam. This was called the world's dangerous slam by Excalibur. So a little change of naming convention there. Hobbs hits pretty much a spin cycle off the turnbuckle, but then when landing, Moxley turns to the armbar and then gets to the rope, and Yuta shows up, hits the Busaiku knee that Paul Turner, of course, misses. Hobbs then catches Moxley with the big spinebuster, straps come down, and he lifts up Moxley and gets caught in the choke, reaches the ropes, and then Shafir nails him with the briefcase. Hobbs kicks out, got like a good reaction. Then Moxley hit the paradigm shift, and dude, everyone bit on this one, and Hobbs kicks out. A tremendous near fall here. I thought this was just so well done. I don't think anyone thought he was kicking out of this. And then Moxie immediately goes to the bulldog choke, and Hobbs passes out with Turner waving it off. No, I have to say, I just thought they did such an excellent job with Hobbs in the, like, he wins the casino gauntlet, and then they did that awesome setup on Saturday. And I have to say, I thought they did a really good job of protecting Hobbs here. I certainly could have understood if, you know, they did the DQ finish. But man, I just feel like the AEW audience, they're so less open to those finishes. I just thought that this was a great handling of this. And I continue to be very impressed with Hobbs in these roles where he comes up short, but we're not at the stage where I think the audience like doesn't believe in him, or it feels like he's just hitting his head against a ceiling. But I enjoyed this. I felt this was much more in line with the match they wanted to have a year ago, but the injury prevented.
Yeah, definitely. And it was nice. You could tell it was nice for both of them to probably, you know, close the circle on that particular note there. I mean, I have my reservations about the number of kind of screwy finishes that this company is going to, and the degree to which they are very clearly just at times like just not willing to cleanly pin somebody and wanting to protect people. Hobbs, this is one of those cases where I think it is at least somewhat justified. So I didn't mind the finish in a vacuum. There was a little bit of just the, well, I know how this is probably going to go part of it. But the fact that this was sort of a, not exactly like lightning in a bottle, but, you know, the winner of the gauntlet being so unexpected, and then it just being a TV defense rather than a pay-per-view one and whatnot. The fact that, again, like you mentioned, you had Hobbs cutting that great promo talking about like doing a better job of kind of underlining the points that theoretically Moxley is and his title reign have been about than he's been doing of late, by sort of saying, you're saying you want guys who want to grab the brass ring and are hungry and do not talk. Well, I'm not talking. So all of that stuff in terms of Hobbs, I thought was really, really good. I thought he looked excellent here. And given kind of the odd spot that it was in with also, is Moxley going to be getting a babyface reaction? How much of one in Cincinnati? They had a lot to kind of balance and juggle there. So given all of that, I thought this came across. It was interesting. It was unique. Again, my qualms about, you know, screwy finishes in this company aside. I enjoyed it as well. Definitely.
Well, the post-match, we have to have a post-match attack. The Death Riders all jump Hobbs, and they attack his previously injured knee, taking it out with a chair, and Moxley blasts the knee. They take off the brace, and then they wrap the chair around the knee, and Claudio leaps up and stomps it. And then Rated FTR's music hits and they come out. I mean, great timing, guys. And typically the baby faces come just as you're about to do the big stomp. But Hobbs is his knee was compromised to a permanent end as Edge and FTR cleared the ring. And that sets the stage for the big 12-man tag that will air on Saturday night. And that was the conclusion of Maximum Carnage. Was your entertainment maximized in these 2 hours and 10 minutes?
I don't know about maximized, but topped up pretty well overall. You know, I think the Omega and Cage match absolutely delivered on the spot that it was placed in and the upside that it had. I enjoyed the women's, gauntlet for what it was. And it was nice to see Hobbs get another little bit of a showcase like this as well. Really, you know, again, qualms about some of the directions that MJF and Jarrett went in aside, I thought that they kept things moving at a pretty good clip throughout this, and the 2 hours moved along quite nicely, I thought.
Yeah, I have to say, as a whole, I thought that this was a fairly strong edition of Dynamite, not like the upper echelon, but I thought overall the key portions, I thought all delivered in various ways, and especially I was very curious to see how Hobbs would perform in this main event, and I think overall you have to give a passing grade to that as well. So there you have it, night one of Maximum Carnage, and Those were our thoughts on tonight's edition of Dynamite. So for everyone that is listening in the free feed, consider going XL at Post Wrestling Cafe, because the party has just started, folks. Me and Bruce, we're going to continue onward. We're going to talk about all the news of the day. We're going to talk about these legal cases. We're going to break down the Odyssey Jones story. We'll talk a bit about Conor McGregor, and we'll also fit in some New Japan and GCW discussion as well. So that is all continuing as Rewind Dynamite concludes over on the Post Wrestling Cafe. This month at PostWrestlingCafe.com, it's your home for XL editions of Rewind to Raw, Dynamite, and SmackDown as we go live for our patrons on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday with XL editions containing the news of the day, questions, and feedback. And throughout the month of January, you get a free month when you sign up for a full year. PostWrestlingCafe.com.
Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Less $830 trade-in slash promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.